Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. I'm in Arizona for the season, watching the local news from afar, and I'm saddened and deeply angered about the recent shooting of a young jazz fan who was innocently attending a live music concert at Dick's Den on North High Street in the Old North or North University area, also called SoHud, at being south of Hudson Street. He was apparently shot in the back through the front window of the place by an unknown shooter who was driving by in a car. He is now paralyzed from the midsection down. I hate guns. I really, really do. And I've said so often on this platform. Many years ago, a friend of mine, Michael Cleveland, a founding member of the local band Intermittent Animals and a longtime employee of the ill-fated and misgoverned Calumet Natural Foods Co-op, was killed in the alley behind his home on East Hudson, also in the so-called SoHud district. He, too, was shot in the back by an unknown assailant. Gun crimes are more numerous today than they have been on average over the previous several decades, and it's foolish to try to divorce that statistic from the fact that more guns are in circulation now than at any point in our history, both as a general statistic and on a per capita basis. We should also note that the vast majority of guns in this country are owned by one particular demographic, the one that is responsible statistically for the majority of crimes in America, white males. White males also own the majority of gun stores, publish all of the gun proliferation magazines, head the pro-gun lobbies and clubs, own nearly all of the shooting ranges, and even most of the elected officials that are backing gun proliferation legislation are white and male. After each mass shooting, we wonder aloud, how many more will it take? How many more have to die before meaningful gun regulation can pass? Yet after each mass shooting, sinister strategists concerned principally with profits promote poppycock notions about some of the big bad government plotting to confiscate people's guns. Gun sales skyrocket, and the cloaked enablers of it all, the shareholders, laugh all the way to the bank. This week, however, a precedent was set that I hope signals a trend. Families of victims of the Sandy Hook school shooting won a massive multi-million-dollar settlement against the gun manufacturer Remington, marking the first time that a gun manufacturer was held liable in the criminal actions of its customers. I'd prefer to see that liability extended also to the shareholders. Why should they get away unscathed? We'll hear in this edition of Conscious Voices part of a press conference announcing the Sandy Hook settlement, but first I want to read you this essay from an author by the name of Robert Harrington that appeared last week in the online journal The Palmer Report. This was in response to the Republican National Committee's resolution approved by a majority of the Republican delegates that described the January 6th insurrection and attempted coup as a legitimate political discourse. He writes, "Some 3 weeks after the Apollo 11th lunar landing and a continent away from the launch pad, a small slithering band of malcontented hippies began a murder spree under the remote control of an evil mastermind named Charles Manson. Their rampage shocked the nation and ended with the deaths of 7 people and an unborn child. Then there's the writer and actress Ali Esiri, who says of William Shakespeare, 'There was a particular moment when I came closest to understanding his depths.' She goes on to relate the true story of a woman in the Theresienstadt Nazi concentration center who was overheard by a guard there quoting from a line of one of Shakespeare's plays. The guard pulled her aside and told her he recognized the quote and told her to run away that night. She managed to escape with her mother and survive the war. Later, she said she wasn't sure, but she thought it was Shakespeare's words that jolted the guard's humanity." These two stories, told from real events, are brought to you by the human race. Both highlight the starting juxtaposition of the good and evil of our species. Both remind us of how far apart good and evil really are, yet how paradoxically both extremes can inhabit the breasts of everyday people. From Moonshot to Manson, from Hitler to humanity, we're accustomed to the side-by-side contrast between the heights our species can achieve and the lowest depths it can plunge to. The cognitive dissonance these contrasts create are the actional background of music for human experience. Few places showcase this contrast better than the building that houses the Congress of the United States. Within that building, men and women of high-minded goodwill work side by side with men and women of low-intentioned depravity. A great deal of nonsense, largely from the media, has gone into the effort to suggest that people on both sides of the aisle are really the same, that their failure to see eye to eye is really a failure of partisanship and nothing more. If only, the talking heads seem to opine, they could set aside their differences and come together in unity, if only. But we'll not be gaslighted. We know the difference between good and evil. It's imprinted in our DNA. The depraved members of Congress who call themselves Republicans know it, too, which is why they so desperately try to disguise their intentions by obfuscation, equivocation, and endless filibusters of whataboutisms. They know perfectly well, for instance, that the January 6, 2021 attack on the very building in which they work was a violent attempt to overthrow the government of the United States, a depraved and open violation of everything they claim to hold sacred. This is why they desperately do not want it investigated. In fact, they're so terrified of having that day investigated that they threaten with prison and censure any members of their own party who cooperate with the January 6th committee. But every child knows that evil prefers darkness. Every child knows that sunlight of scrutiny is inimical to the shadow of corruption. Republicans know it too, and they tremble. And so we are tired, tired of the relentless exasperation-promoting battle for our sanity, the twisting and turning of words, the clockwork mechanism that measures the good and evil of legislation, not by its true merits, but by the party of the people promoting it. We're tired of the relentless assault on democracy, on voting rights, on science, and we will not be gaslighted. We are particularly tired of making heroes out of scum, merely because they agree with the obvious. The sky is blue, and January 6th was an insurrection, an outrage against the very foundation of American government. What do those who acknowledge the absurdly incontrovertible want, a medal? Remember, Liz Cheney, Adam Kissinger are climate science denialists who voted to make the rich richer and do nothing for the poor, who voted against voting rights and who want to criminalize abortion. They are scum. So they say out loud what is plain to the simplest fool, goody for them. We will not be gaslighted. Sometimes there aren't two sides to every story. Sometimes there's just the truth on one side and shameless lies on the other. There are certainly no two sides to this story, no two schools of thought here. There are only people acting in good faith and opposing the subversion of the will of the people by criminals who are trying to steal the 2020 election for a thin-skinned poisoned toad. Of the liars who cover for him, their side is nothing but an exasperating escalation of one absurdity on top of another. They're held in the thrall of an insidious man-child who we will not be gaslighted. We refuse to be lectured about how January 6th was a harmless protest, just as we refuse to be lectured about how Hillary Clinton's emails by members of a party who support an ex-president who ate or took home in boxes or flushed down the toilet top secret documents. Those days are over for good. I hope Republicans at least have enough shame by now to acknowledge just how stupid they look when they pretend to care about the rule of law. Astrology is not astronomy. Alchemy is not chemistry. Psychokinesis is not psychology. We will not be gaslighted. Those politicians on the right who come to their points of view not by way of careful thought or years of dedicated study. Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. I'm in Arizona for the season, watching the local news from afar, and I'm saddened and deeply angered about the recent shooting of a young jazz fan who was innocently attending a live music concert at Dick's Den on North High Street in the Old North or North University area, also called SoHud, being south of Hudson Street. He was apparently shot in the back through the front window of the place by an unknown shooter who was driving by in a car. He is now paralyzed from the midsection down. I hate guns. I really, really do. And I've said so often on this platform. Many years ago, a friend of mine, Michael Cleveland, a founding member of the local band Intermittent Animals and a longtime employee of the ill-fated and misgoverned Calumet Natural Foods Co-op, was killed in the alley behind his home on East Hudson, also in the so-called Sohud District. He, too, was shot in the back by an unknown assailant. Gun crimes are more numerous today than they have been on average over the previous several decades, and it's foolish to try to divorce that statistic from the fact that more guns are in circulation now than at any point in our history, both as a general statistic and on a per capita basis. We should also note that the vast majority of guns in this country are owned by one particular demographic, the one that is responsible statistically for the majority of crimes in America, white males. White males also own the majority of gun stores, publish all of the gun proliferation magazines, head the pro-gun lobbies and clubs, own nearly all of the shooting ranges, and even most of the elected officials that are backing gun proliferation legislation are white and male. After each mass shooting, we wonder aloud, how many more will it take? How many more have to die before meaningful gun regulation can pass? Yet after each mass shooting, sinister strategists concerned principally with profits promote poppycock notions about some of the big bad government plotting to confiscate people's guns. Gun sales skyrocket, and the cloaked enablers of it all, the shareholders, laugh all the way to the bank. This week, however, a precedent was set that I hope signals a trend. Families of victims of the Sandy Hook school shooting won a massive multi-million-dollar settlement against the gun manufacturer Remington, marking the first time that a gun manufacturer was held liable in the criminal actions of its customers. I'd prefer to see that liability extended also to the shareholders. Why should they get away unscathed? We'll hear in this edition of Conscious Voices part of a press conference announcing the Sandy Hook settlement. But first I want to read you this essay from an author by the name of Robert Harrington that appeared last week in the online journal The Palmer Report. This was in response to the Republican National Committee's resolution approved by a majority of the Republican delegates that described the January 6th insurrection and attempted coup as a legitimate political discourse. But by abject greed, cowardice, laziness, and a complete absence of intellectual rigor, their supporters among the American people come by their points of view because they are ignorant, lazy, stupid, or deliberately obtuse. We will no longer stand by and agree to acknowledge obfuscation, equivocation, and whataboutisms as legitimate debate. We will not allow an attack on the foundations of democracy to be called legitimate political discourse. Enough is enough. We will not be gaslighted. And as ever, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, comrades and friends, stay safe. That was an essay by Robert Harrington titled We Will Not Be Gaslighted, and it was published in the Palmer Report, where Harrington is a regular contributor. Here's part of the Sandy Hook Settlement news conference, where you'll learn some interesting things about Remington, the company that manufactured the gun used by disturbed teen Adam Lanza to kill numerous students and teachers at the Sandy Hook Elementary School.
In about 5 minutes, an AR-15, a combat weapon. This is the AR-15 on the floor of the first grade classroom. Was used not by a highly trained soldier, but by a deeply troubled kid. Not on a battlefield abroad, but in an elementary school at home. And not to preserve freedoms, but to eviscerate them. When we first looked into the case, we thought it was really about the gun, and it is. The gun is it has a role here. But there was a chilling part to what we learned that was comparable to this, and that was about greed. It was about greed. The case was really about the gun, but it's just as much about greed. Once the AR-15 was adopted by the military, it was available to the civilian population. For decades, you could get an AR-15. For decades. But the market was kind of small. It was a very niche market. Why was the market small for an AR-15? Because nobody really felt they wanted one or needed one. Nobody had their identity caught up in whether they held an AR-15. Nobody was so fragile that they needed an AR-15 combat weapon to prove something. And a lot of people just didn't know enough or care enough to see if they could get one. However, there was a market of responsible people, a market of specialists, a market of people who knew what an AR-15 was and knew what the responsibility was of owning an AR-15. These were people maybe like target hunters or people on gun ranges, those kind of things. For about 40 years, the market was small. In fact, Remington, which is an iconic American company, which I can, with some pride, talking about old Remington now, can say has deep roots here in Connecticut. There's a Remington factory in Bridgeport that was very integral in the Remington brand. And for decades, Remington didn't sell an AR-15. In fact, when the DuPonts owned Remington, they didn't even sell handguns. They were content to carry on the tradition, the proud tradition of the country, which is very much part of who we are, of hunting, right? So the Remington was all about that tradition, safety. And of course they were interested in profit. But you know what they cared about just as much as profit? They cared about people. Starting with their own people, their employees. They were good to their employees. They wouldn't fire somebody who had been working there for 30 years simply because that person had a big salary and was starting to lose efficiency. And they were responsible. Remington was a very responsible company. What Remington proved is that you can be in the gun industry and be profitable and also be responsible. That's what they proved in almost 200 years. Until they were taken over by Cerberus, which is a private equity firm in Midtown Manhattan. Greed kills. When the idea of private equity money going into the gun industry was novel, was creative, and turned out to be, for a while anyway, extremely successful. Extremely successful. It was, if you could take away everything else about it, it was brilliant. It was brilliant. The minds at this private equity firm looked at the landscape of the gun industry, and they didn't see big Fortune 500 company here, big Fortune 500 company there. This wasn't the oil industry where you have somebody who knows more about this, but like that, how you have like all these different publicly traded companies. These were all small, privately owned niche companies, some of which were like Remington, built from the ground up by somebody who had skin in the game, who was proud of their product and good to their workers and responsible. People like the Bushmaster founder, Richard Dyke, who had built Bushmaster. And Bushmaster was a company that was selling and specialized in AR-15s. They were one of five or six companies, small companies, that made AR-15s at the time that this private equity firm got involved. And what private equity does, for those of you who didn't know, it's going to be a lesson in private equity and guns and gun. I mean, it was, but you go where the evidence takes you. And what private equity does is they look for these opportunities to take all these small little component parts and they roll them up, right? So instead of having five marketing departments, that you have one. Instead of having five manufacturing plants, you have one. The obvious implications of that is you could do more with less and more effectively and spend less. And that's what they did. And they had, and the private equity firm, unlike Remington and Sons, which was built to provide value and something built by hand, like, and built in America, actually, also their hunting rifles, and was passed on in the family and to and the people who were treated like family. The private equity goal here was unabashedly, there was only one goal. Let's turn this gun, let's build a gun conglomerate and turn it into a billion-dollar a year massive behemoth gun industry, gun company. And that was pretty much unheard of. Even the publicly traded companies were probably not the size of that goal was set to meet. And when you're building a market, marketing was also a big part of this case. We're moving on, in essence, from the gun to these other principles of fair dealing, these principles of responsibility. And while you could say that some gun companies don't have, with some argument that the gun companies don't show a lot of responsibility, what about the private equity firms that take homegrown operations and they strip them of all their personality in the effort to make money? And so when these two things collided with Cerberus, In about 2005, roughly when this was all brewing, there were about 100,000 AR-15s sold in America. In 2012, the year of the Sandy Hook, there were over 2 million. What an incredible accomplishment. How do you take, I mean, first of all, it's hard enough to make a new product and tell people they need it, they should want it, that they are not, that there's some attraction to it that's going to cause them to want the weapon, in this case, a weapon. But how do you take a product that's just been sitting there and do that? That's masterful. That's masterful. And they did it in a very smart way. First, they knew they had a built-in customer base of gun owners because gun owners are whatever the stat is, 40% of people own guns, something like that. Don't quote me on that. But they had an established customer base. But obviously, those customers hadn't been enticed to buy an AR-15 because their natural instincts would be, why do I need that? I've got my hunting rifle. I've got my home defense, you know, gun or shotgun. You know, I don't need some. I don't need to play military in my neighborhood. Why do I need that? So that was one of their target. But if you could convince them to buy one, what a boon that would be, considering just do the numbers. It's all math. And then their second goal was to try to find a market that had not been exposed to guns yet. Not the older established gun purchaser, but a new market of young people who had never owned a weapon. They call this in marketing targeting an end user. Targeting an end user. This is what I learned. And targeting an end user, somebody explained it to me like this. Our kids probably, if you have kids, somewhere along the lines, they were interested, we wanted something from the Disney Corporation. The Disney Corporation is not targeting us, right? They're targeting our kids. We are the purchaser. But we're just the vessel that delivers the money to Disney. We are being pushed by our kids, and we want to do our kids, well, we try, within some moderation. But you get the picture. They target the end user. And they were very specific about targeting this market. And how do you target people who have never owned a weapon? You have to do this, you have to convince them they need it. The younger male demographic, tap into their anxieties about masculinity. Tap into their feelings of aggrievement or insecurity. Maybe you're tapping into their lack of being physically strong. Tell them that this weapon conveys power and masculinity. You bet, you know what, if somebody had offered me something that conveyed power and masculinity, even today I would take it. But back then, I would definitely take it. I would take that in a heartbeat. I would take it in a heartbeat. And I bet you all know people like this who would grab that opportunity. And they did it in many different ways. Very clever, very orchestrated. So let's show the old Bushmaster. First of all, they had rolled up Bushmaster. One of the problems is they had four companies that were all selling AR-15s, or three of them were. So anyway, this is an old-fashioned Bushmaster marketing. Now, if a troubled young person who probably shouldn't have a weapon in their hands looks at this, no problem. This ain't a sale, right? But what about the responsible gun owner that we always hear about, that apparently is the iconic gun owner that the industry is seeking? Well, the responsible gun owner could say, I want an AR-15. Look at these specifications. And this is how the engagement happened, right? This is Bushmaster before the acquisition. And this is not going to, this is going to be, you're not going to get the off the chart sales that they were looking for to make their $1 billion. But you are going to get a customer who has a desire, a natural desire for a weapon, and has the inclination to get it. Next. Here's what they did to one of the things they did, you know, because they were capitalizing on the ability to reach directly around the parents into the bedrooms of children and teenagers and young adults, and they knew it. They knew it. We know they know it. We know they know it. And all they were really doing, in fairness, was using the modern means of communication to reach a target audience. So these are just examples of banners they use. Jeff stayed at home to watch Mamma Mia with his fiancée instead of coming to poker night with the boys. And Jeff is a crier. And what they would do with this particular man card campaign is you could also, I don't think we have it on here, but you could also report somebody. So if somebody was not a a man, you could turn in your friends and say this, and then you would enter their email addresses, and no doubt you would get you'd plant their email, and then you would be delivering to Bushmaster, which was one of the brands of this conglomeration that became Remington. They would have that person's email in it for marketing purposes. You could report your friend for not being a man because they don't own a book. And Bushmaster wanted to know that because now they're like, okay, think about that for a second. You've been reported by your friend. Maybe you're not somebody who would normally want to be interested in a weapon like this, but your friend has just turned you in. He thinks you're a wimp. And you see your lifeline to masculinity. It was actually really smart, wasn't it? It was really smart. Take away everything else. It was really smart. All right. And then everybody's seen this. This is with the payoff that you would get. And the it's a good thing all these families are sitting down. The thing is that Cerberus, who was sort of the oversight, but it was really through a holding company called Freedom Group, which became Remington. Forget ever unnecessary complications. But what they did was they were so successful at sort of raising this product from the ashes, and the sales were going through the roof. And what happens when it's like when you see the stock, when somebody sees a stock going up, they want to be part of it. They want to rush in, right? And that's exactly what happened. All of their competitors were saying, hey, you know that dusty old AR-15 that nobody wanted? It's a cash cow. It's a cash cow. And we know this. We know this because you can see it in the sales charts. Because this is an industry that tracks what each other's doing like no other industry. Everybody knows everybody else's business. And they sort of look over. And so, for example, Smith & Wesson, seeing this explosion in sales, which was also very much the product of the stoking of the fear of President Obama taking everybody's guns. Smith & Wesson, which was one of the competitors of this gun conglomerate, who had also never sold an AR-15, got into the AR-15 game. And just I think it's appropriate to say, and we all know that the Smith & Wesson product was used, an AR-15, by another troubled young man in Parkland. And it is likely that Smith & Wesson never would have made an AR-15 to market to kids or young adults like this had this effort not been so successful. But think about what happens, the basic supply and demand. Think about what happens now. Everybody's rushing in. There had been about six or seven before Cerberus started, companies that were making AR-15s before, all very small. By 2009 and 10, there were like 31 companies making AR-15s. Now, what happens when you have this onslaught of supply and the president that you were saying was going to take away everybody's guns doesn't? Then you have a problem with demand. And how do you start out, now that all these players have rushed in, by distinguishing your product, your brand, from the others? Marketing. Marketing. It's the only way. You know why? All AR-15s function the same. They all function the same. I'm sure you get somebody to say, oh, the guy doesn't know what he's talking about. This one has this thing. They are all functionally equivalent. So the only way to distinguish it is with marketing and branding. And with the intense competition, they had to take that next step. They had to cash in on their, Bushmaster in particular was the brand associated with things that are not legal, for example, like combat, you know, for civilians. Combat is not a legal thing to engage in with a AR-15 in our streets and neighborhoods. Assaultive kind of things and all these slogans. And they will tell you this is made for hunting, but where's the animal? Where's the animal in this? They will tell you it's made for target shooting. Really? They will tell you it has all these different things that it doesn't have, and that's why nobody bought this product except for a small niche of people, because they knew what the weapon was for, and they, whatever that purpose was, it wasn't any of those things. But to distinguish, so what they did was again, another brilliant idea, they started a sister kind of product called the Adaptive Combat Rifle, and they to distinguish the Bushmaster brand. And if you're going to buy, branding is important, because if I'm going to buy, to use our friend Dylan's favorite cereals, Cheerios, and there's a Honey Nut Cheerios, I'm in, right? So the Honey Nut Cheerios branding is working on me to buy Cheerios. The regular Cheerios is cross-branding. So the Bushmaster brand was carving out this niche market. And so here's, they upped the ante. So that's another Bushmaster ad. I will just point out that's a lone gunman. That's a lone gunman, and this is, you know, and so getting this type of thing out to the commercial market is just, it just is what it is. You can see it. It's in plain sight. And this is what, in furtherance of their branding. So, but when they, to distinguish themselves on the ACR, they went the next level. First of all, they developed something, first of all, it's called an adaptive combat rifle. To your friends and neighbors, they will sell you an adaptive combat rifle. Just stop right there and think about that. First of all, why would they, and look at the messaging, clear the room, cover the rooftop, rescue the hostage. Do I even need to put out the man card that is conferred? They're not selling, this is not marketing to the military. The military doesn't need man cards. They don't need man cards. And the executives at this organization would refer to the people who they were targeting with Bushmaster and their sister DPMS as wannabes. And if you think about the implications of clearing the room, I mean, what message could they possibly sending that is lawful? What message? Forces of opposition bow down. You have been single-handedly outnumbered. It is true that during this marketing and this effort to make $1 billion, largely on the backs of the AR-15 and military combat weapons, there had not been as many school shootings, of course, as there are today. However, Wasn't everybody around at Columbine? Wasn't everybody around at Virginia Tech? Why would you make a weapon to have people force oppositions down, bow down if that could happen? And why would you market it to the target audience they were marketing it to if you were a responsible company, let alone in... Remington never did this with their hunting rifles. And this is a little bit of the, I would say it's the sort of the pièce de résistance, what was that for? Pièce de résistance? Remington got really lucky having developed an association with Activision in the enormously successful Call of Duty franchise. And this was one of those modern ways to market a weapon to circumvent the traditional barriers of children that you would have with children, because children aren't going to march into a gun store and order a gun magazine, right? And teenagers, I would say. But this is a way to reach underage people as well as lawfully aged people with marketing, and it's so effective. It's so effective. And actually, there were naysayers at Remington who said, I don't know. They were amazed. They were amazed at how lifelike this was. And there was one comment that was made was, we used to have to get people out to the gun range to show that our weapons had little recoil. You don't need to do that anymore. And when a 12-year-old made a replica of a functioning ACR, this is... anyway, when a family... This is my hook, I guess I'm getting. But everybody's like, yay. But when the families, they saw the pay dirt, they saw the pay dirt in this, and they feature. Of course, this there's no controlling what message this reaches, and they understood that people who playing the game, who would experience this rifle, would then go online to look at the product, and that's by their own admission, essentially. Okay. That's enough of a background. But so many we hear about these things and we think of them out theoretically, like what is the weapon, what is the marketing up to it. It really doesn't, until you see the whole picture. For me, at least, it didn't really add up. And that's when I realized that we had a problem with greed and irresponsibility going all around in this case. If this wasn't the gun industry, but literally any other industry, nobody would have sort of batted an eyelash when we filed this lawsuit on behalf of these wonderful families. Nobody, because you would have said, of course the people who were pushing this should be held accountable, or at least you should have the right to investigate and look into whether the conduct, as we all do. This is the great equalizer. And I was thinking, yeah, of course. And then somebody pointed out to me that there was actually a law that was different for the gun industry than anybody else. So after finally feeling some comfort about, I'm not just going to be me and all my colleagues, because this is, if ever there was a team effort, it's been this one, but that we had a legal problem here. We're practicing lawyers have been around for a while. We were practicing in 2005. None of us had ever heard of this law. But apparently in 2005, the NRA went to Congress and basically asked Congress for a favor. They said they wanted protections where people were injured or killed by their guns, even if the industry or the company did something wrong. They wanted special protections. And of course, our whole judicial system has developed over a long period of time to create a balance between the rights of individuals and the rights of companies, as it should be. And it's worked out, right? So we all know that this is important to hold corporations accountable, and that also creates better conduct. And when Congress was asked to choose between the ordinary rights of families have to pursue just cases and hold industries accountable on the one hand, and the bottom line of the gun industry on the other, Congress, which could have said no, they could have said let the regular rules apply, Congress put its thumb on the bottom line of the gun industry. And of course, that made the industry very happy, But it did something worse. It gave the industry a perception that nothing they did could ever be evaluated. Nothing that they did could ever be subject to scrutiny. Nothing they did could ever lead to liability. And that made gun companies a very nice, tidy partnership for insurance companies. What's better for an insurance company than collecting a premium that you don't think you have to pay out on? And what is more dangerous than any industry believing that they can do whatever they want if profit is the only motive? That they have no skin in the game, no responsibility to families of people injured, the laws don't apply to them. And that perception, I think, is the worst thing about PLACA that was done. There, we met some really good people who were in the gun industry. I liked them. I saw fathers and grandfathers. Even the executives that I would be prone not, you know, whatever, I would have had a sort of a hesitancy. I saw human beings. But when human beings are gathered together simply to make profit and they don't believe that they can be held responsible for anything, bad things happen. And that's what happened. And this today, we're here, believe it or not, after that, to report a settlement in this case. A settlement in this case, which, I'll be honest, I'm not sure I always, you know, I had some cold feet going into the case, which is not for today's purposes. But here we are. During the odyssey that this case has been in, we established what was clearly true, which is that PLACA is a barrier, but PLACA is not bulletproof. The immunity protecting the gun industry is not bulletproof. And if anything comes out of this case, and the families pray and hope that it will, it's to have what happened to them happen to other people is just too shattering. But if anything that will do that, I think it's that it has shattered that perception. And the gun industry, we hope the gun industry takes this under advisement. We hope they realize that they have skin into the game. Instead of blaming literally everybody else, school systems for not having security to defend against their weapons, mentally disabled people like Dylan Hockley, and law enforcement that doesn't do a good enough job protecting us from their products, and basically literally everybody else. We are just, the ask here is very humble. What can you do? What can you do? How can you help? How can you help fix this? Everybody else is trying. There was hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars, invested in school security. The schools are trying. It's time to stop, you know, saddling everything on mentally ill people as if there is one mentally ill person and that's the same as every other mentally ill person, and stigmatizing things like autism. Just, you don't have to do much. You know, just don't target the audience. Don't do that marketing. That's the first step. That's easy. That's what a friend of mine would say, sleeves off the vest. It's such low hanging, and that's not a new law. You're in charge of that. Do it. Do it tomorrow. You know, and tell us about it. The families would be so heartened to hear that. That's a first step, but not a last. And insurance companies, it's time for you to start treating gun industry like you treat me every time I get a speeding ticket. You're all over me. You raise my rates. You send me to class. That doesn't happen, but theoretically. Where's the oversight? Have you ever heard of an insurance company standing behind an insured that has no care whatsoever for the risk they're creating? And that increases the risk of things going bad? Where's the oversight? This can be done. This can be done. This is not the end of times for the gun industry. The gun industry will always be part of our culture. It will always be there. Take the lessons of old Remington. Know your people. Treat them well. One thing I forgot to mention is that, among other things, they just summarily fired people, closed up shop. No one guy who we met 30 years on the job at Remington, Tuesday, just a regular day, take your stuff, you're out. The settlement that, as I understand it, has not been reported. As many of you may know, Remington, during the pendency of this litigation, went essentially bankrupt not once, but twice. That's what happened when after Cerberus got involved, a 200-year company in pretty short order, two bankruptcies. And we had nothing to do with that, which also tells you that you maybe all this effort to, maybe there's a downside, maybe it doesn't make sense. They did it to themselves. And because they were bankrupt, we were limited in the types of, in the amount of damages that could be recovered. But this case was never about damages from the point of view, damages is typically what lawyers refer to, that's how they call money, compensation. But this case was never about damages in the sense of compensation. It was about damages in the sense of forcing change. It was about damages in the sense of realizing the goals of these families to do what, remember, to do whatever they can to help prevent the next Sandy Hook. And if there's any message that you get after learning about all this is they don't care about it's money that gets their attention. It's money that gets any industry's attention, especially this industry that is so not used to parting with it, and especially those who underwrite the industry, like the insurance companies. So it was really important that they get damages, and it was really important that they get a lot of damages, because it has to be something that gets the attention of this industry and it's in the insurance and banking industries. But that was limited because of the bankruptcy. There was the total amount of insurance available to these families was $73 million. That's what the insurance companies paid. They were looking at the same evidence we were. So the settlement is $73 million. That's all there was. That's all there was. You really have not had, you're really in a situation that is very unique when you experience something like somebody being told they're getting a certain amount of money, a lot of money, and having that hurt. These families, they would pay everything. They'd give it all back just for 1 minute. That would be true justice. But the other thing I just have to mention is that they would have told these insurance companies to pound sand if it was just them offering the money and trying to move on. From the beginning, it was not about money. It was about finding out, getting answers, learning about these decisions. And the linchpin of this settlement is that it allows these families the rights to share the information as to what they learned with the public. And so much is happening so quickly. You can imagine there are hundreds of thousands of documents. I would say stay tuned, but that's not what today is about. And I'm just going to finish up. It's really rare to do something as a lawyer in a law firm. Where's my lawyer? Where the public actually is like, oh, wow. Let's put it this way. You don't get a lot of love letters as a lawyer. And when we filed this case, we heard from so many people of goodwill. Of course we had the expected, you know, people who weren't thrilled with the case. But we got so much an outpouring of support. And from doctors, from trauma surgeons who were just sick and tired of being devastated by seeing wounds that were battlefield wounds in children and young adults and teenagers and grandparents. And people wanted to send us money. Imagine somebody wanting to send a lawyer money. I've never heard of such a thing. You know you're doing something pretty good when that happens. And I just want to read a letter I got to you from somebody named Abigail from Minnesota. Abigail wrote, Regarding Donna Soto et al. Versus Bushmaster Firearms, I read of your suit in the New York Times. And I'm enclosing a small check to be placed towards the attorney's fees. Thank you for taking this on. If we don't tilt at windmills, we will never topple them. This is important work, and the community of Newtown are not forgotten. And she sent a check for $25, which I actually haven't cashed, but if anybody has a, but and I may have just lost, but here it is. You know, you don't have to see it, just take my word for it. There's a check in here for $25. So, this world has a lot more Abigails. There's a lot of Abigails out there. You may not hear from them, but they're out there. So now I'll turn it over to the families. Finally, okay, it's time to bring it to an end. And this is who you really need to listen to. I'm just so honored that they have the courage to get up here. Hannah DeVino would like to say a few words about her sister Rachel.
Rachel was one of a kind. She always stood up for what was right. From a very young age, she faced adversity with grace. Rachel was... Picture.
Thank you.
Rachel was really beginning her life when she was murdered. She was taking fertility tests to make sure she didn't need to go to the doctor to have children. Her boyfriend was going to propose to her on Christmas, and she never got the chance to see her engagement ring, which was her grandmother's. And I will never forget walking into the funeral home and seeing her in her casket. We had an open casket funeral, and her friends worked tirelessly to make sure that we didn't see the remnants of what happened to her. But you could still tell with the veil on her head and the box on her chest and them hiding her right hand, her left hand, and putting her engagement ring on her right hand, that what she went through was brutal. The medical examiner could not be certain if she was shot 9 or 11 times due to ricochets and reentry wounds. And this was only her second week of school at Sandy Hook School. This should not have happened, and it should not happen to anybody else. Thank you.
This is a picture of Rachel, and we still feel her spirit, but every single day we miss who Rachel would be.
I'd like to preface my statement by saying that my heart goes out to the parents of the Parkland victims. They marked a terrible anniversary yesterday, 4 years. I thought December 14th, 2012 would be just an ordinary day and a string of ordinary days. But my little boy, Noah, never came home from school that day. I invite you all to imagine one moment we had this dazzling, energetic, 6-year-old little boy, and the next, all we had left were echoes of the past, photographs of a lost child who will never grow older, calendars marking a horrifying new anniversary, and a lonely grave and pieces of Noah's life now stored in boxes and in his school backpack. Every day is a realization that he should be here, yet he's not. Those of you who have never lost a child don't want to imagine, and those who have know what I mean. What is lost remains lost forever. Today marks an inflection point when our duty of care to our children as a society finally supersedes the bottom line of an industry that made such an atrocity as Sandy Hook possible to begin with. Today is a day of accountability for an industry that has thus far enjoyed operating with immunity and impunity. And for this, I am grateful. Thank you.
A little over 9 years ago, I saw my two children get onto a school bus. Just another normal Friday at the start of a busy holiday season. I was excited to see my youngest, Dylan, later that afternoon, knowing I'd be going to his classroom to make gingerbread houses. We never made a gingerbread house, and Dylan never came home. The next time I saw him was in his casket, where I was able to hold his hands but not touch his body, which had been shot 5 times, killing him instantly in his first grade classroom. We moved our family from England to America because of our belief in the American dream, the land of possibilities, where a brighter future was achievable for our children and where Dylan could receive the best support for his autism. Less than 2 years after moving to Newtown, our dream turned into the American nightmare, where for too many, the right to bear arms is a higher priority than the right to life. Our nightmare is the same as that of far too many families who have suffered death by firearms. Our hope to create change is also shared by those families. Nobody wants to experience what we live with every day. After Dylan's murder, I made a very early promise to do everything in my power to honor his short life by creating change that would save the lives of other children and prevent mass shootings like the one that destroyed our family. This lawsuit has been part of that promise. When we first started speaking to different law firms about our ideas, we kept hearing it was impossible, an unwinnable case, that firearm manufacturers were immune, untouchable, and that though they expressed their deepest sympathies for our loss, there was nothing they could do. Josh Koscoff and his firm were different. The only ones that believed in the art of the possible, or maybe didn't realize what they were stepping into.
It was that one.
It was that one. I'm trying to do you a good one here, Josh. But they believed there was a way to crack the gun industry's impenetrable armor. And I'm grateful for the other law firms that also stepped up to support this case in so many ways. For 8 long years, we've continued our fight to hold Remington accountable for its role in prioritizing profit above safety and using reckless marketing techniques to appeal to at-risk and violence-prone young men. Marketing that has targeted those that want to appear more intimidating, more powerful, and more masculine through the use of their AR-15. The thousands of internal documents obtained in discovery for this case paint a picture of a company that lost its way, choosing more aggressive marketing campaigns for profit with no thought to the impact on their intended target user, and we can't wait to share those documents. The Sandy Hook shooter chose the AR-15 for his massacre because of its ability to inflict the most lethal damage in the shortest amount of time. It's not a useful weapon for hunting or for self-defense. It was designed to kill quickly and efficiently. The Sandy Hook shooter helped fulfill that purpose, shooting 154 bullets in less than 5 minutes and killing 26 innocent people, including my 6-year-old son. The gun industry has been shielded from being held accountable for their part in these tragedies. Today, that changes. Gun manufacturing will continue. People will still purchase firearms, and I hope they continue to use these weapons safely and responsibly. But this victory, this landmark historic victory, sends a forceful and compelling message to manufacturers and to the insurance and banking industries that support them. This is a high-risk market. It is not profitable, and you will be held accountable. Nothing will bring Dylan back. The closest I get to him now is by kissing his urn every night, telling him I love him and I miss him. But I made him a promise, and I'll keep working to deliver that promise for the rest of my life. My hope for this lawsuit is that by facing and finally being penalized for the impact of their work, gun companies, along with the insurance and banking industries that enable them, will be forced to make their practices safer than they've ever been, which will save lives and stop more shootings.
That was a press conference announcing the multi-million-dollar settlement awarded to families of the Sandy Hook school shooting victims, implicating the Remington Firearms Company. And this has been Conscious Voices, heard each week at this time on your community radio stations, WCRSLP 92.7 and 98.3 FM, and WGRNLP 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis, and I'll see you all next week again for another edition. Take care. The program you are listening to is broadcast both on community radio station WCRS via translator W245AY at 98.3 FM and on WGRN 94.1 FM. WCRSFM.org and WGRN.org. If you like what you're hearing or want to get involved, please visit those websites and give what you can. Both stations are non-commercial and volunteer-run. Both stations depend on listener support. Again, the websites are WCRSFM.org for WCRS and WGRN.org for WGRN.